This past month up in Toronto at the Audio Engineering Society's 4-day digital immersion bath, and there have been a number of people up there too, who asked about what can be done for restoration and where the most likely product that would be saleable should be focused for archival use. And in both cases, I responded the clicks and pops aspect of things. And that seems to have been feedback they got from other people up there as well. So that may be a direction that things are moving in. As far as background noise is concerned, that problem of the changing linear speed of the 78 is still one that is creating problems. And though tape may well be under control in this regard, I still think there are 78 surface noise problems yet to be dealt with. Yes, Susan.
Suzanne Stover, Eastman School of Music. I have a few questions for Seth concerning the cleaning of acetate discs. Yeah. Do you ever use Freon for stubborn mold, or do you find that the mineral oil takes care of even that?
The mineral oil will work. I wouldn't hit it with Freon because that's a very severe drying agent. That'll take out any of the oil that's on there, and what will happen is the acetate can dry off and flake right away. I know someone who did that, and he rued the day he did it.
And are you using tap water or distilled? It looked like you were using a tap.
We were using tap water for the rinse, but the final cleaning on the monks is with distilled water. Oh, something else I forgot to add into that. When you do the last rinse with the soap solution, and it looks clean, the final one should be done just with the photo flow, because soap leaves a very, very fine film. The photo flow will cut through that and take it off.
Also, for the labels that haven't fallen off, do you try to remove them to clean the disc, or do you just clean around the labels?
We clean around the label, try to avoid as much water on those labels if possible. We had a problem with a couple of VOA discs again, unfortunately. It was the first batch of, I think, aluminums in late 1944 that had just come back into production. And we had cleaned, we had cleaned and the labels had gotten slightly wet. And what we had done was tacked it down with J-Lar tape. That was something else I wanted to bring out. Tacked it down with J-Lar tape, and I had the page double-check these records when I was ready to dub it. She brings one over to me, and the label had apparently lifted part of the acetate off. And when I looked underneath, the problem was that the acetate base didn't look clean. It looked like it had been oxidized. In other words, it wasn't polished properly before they had dipped it. So what we do now is that when we put reattach one of these labels, we put just one piece of tape to hold it on in place. So this way, if it curls, it's just going to curl one way.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
One important aspect, which we didn't get into here with the acetate discs. My experience has been, do not clean an acetate disc until you're ready to record it. Don't go clean everything on the shelf and store it that way, because all you do is clear the surface for whatever has leached out and oxidized to go away, so that there's room for more to come out from the inside. At least the crud on the top holds in whatever is left in the record until you're ready to clean it prior to your playing. So delay on that. As far as the Plasmon system is concerned, I'd also like to add that Fred Granger, who is Fred here? Fred has been in and out and hasn't been feeling well. But the Museum of Man in Ottawa has been using the CompuSonic system at its slowest speed. I don't know whether they're using Plasmon discs or not. No.
I don't know.
Okay. But they have been using it for dubbing cylinders of folk music, where they have confirmed that there is nothing on them over 3,000 cycles. It's simply a convenient way for them to store and retrieve items. But that is the one institutional library I know which is using any of the optical Write One systems for our sound archival use. Do you know of any others?
Not at the moment. I think everybody, especially the British Library National Sound Archive, is really waiting to get a really strong fix on the archival life. And then I think there might well be a lot of interest.
Yes, Jack Saul.
Yes, Jack Saul, Cleveland, Ohio. And I would, the very informative program, an excellent program. I have two questions, and one in regard to preservation and one in regard to optical discs. In regard to preservation, can you relate to using Windex as a cleaning agent?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. That has ammonia in it. Ammonia is another drying agent that reacts with the acetate.
Okay.
I wouldn't go near that.
Okay.
With a 10-foot pole.
How about cleaning 78s or LPs?
I'd strongly suggest not using something like that. I'd prefer using the soap solution with the PhotoFlow. I find that's one of the cleanest things that works. Actually, the best thing is the Monk's machine. If you can afford, what is it now, $2,000 for that machine? There are others out there, but the Monk's is the best one concerning coarse groove cuts.
Do all Monk's machines take a 16-inch record?
No. The one you saw, I had to re-drill. We had one that was sent in. You have to tell them when it's sent in that you want the template set for 16-inch, which is essentially the rest being moved a little bit further over, and also the pump where the brushes has to be moved further back. And that's essentially it. The overhang is correct for the suction. But I would absolutely say no way use Windex on that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, in regard to the optical disc, would you comment, please, about the notorious references in many articles and magazines mm-hmm. to laser rot, which is the deterioration of that layer in the middle, not using platinum. Mm-hmm. Would you comment also in regard to the cost of platinum and to the articles that are now beginning to appear that there's so much dissatisfaction with the compact disc quality and its deterioration that one record manufacturer said they're coming back with the long play records?
Nice. Let me start with the laser rot. I think, as I was trying to indicate, there are a lot of different types of optical disc. Compact discs. Compact discs, I suspect, although I haven't seen any real hard scientific studies, can either be good quality and have long archival life if they're well made with a thick layer of aluminum, or maybe they're not so well made, in which case they won't last as long. As far as right ones discs are concerned, then there are a variety of different recording technologies, and they have varying degrees of archival life. The indications are that platinum looks good, and it is better than many of the others, if not all of the others.
The cost.
As far as cost of platinum, it's actually a very thin layer of platinum which goes down. And I don't have the precise figure, but it's of the order of $0.50 of platinum, which goes down per disc. So that's not too bad. All of the cost comes, in fact, in terms of the capital equipment which is required to produce the discs, and also the very detailed testing which goes on every disc before it's sold. So the platinum is actually a relatively small portion of the cost. A single-sided 200 megabyte disc, recommended retail price is $65. And the final question.
The final question was regard to
quality.
One manufacturer stating that there's so much dissatisfaction with the laser compact disc that they're going to come back with a long play record.
In terms of digital recording, then it's a function of a subjective view to some extent, and I think some people are very keen on audio CD type quality and convenience, and there are some critics. But again, as I think I was trying to point out, the quality of the digital recording is a very strong function of the number of bits sampled and the sample rate, and that's a function of the hardware. And at the moment, there are commercial systems which give CD rates and 16-bit resolution. And there are companies who are poised to produce even higher quality systems.
To that, there's also one other very important factor to consider, which is that the digital system is a system. And in rough, it breaks down into two halves. One is the encoding and processing of the digital signal, and the other is the means of storing that system, that signal. Even if you get your digital signal perfect, you still need something which will then reproduce it properly when you store it. One of the problems they're having now is that these workstations where you have hard disks on which the digital signal is processed, they still don't know what to put it on for long-term storage. They still have to put it onto magnetic medium to take it out, or else into something, is a product similar to yours, which I think they're beginning to do.
Yes.
There are a multiplicity of factors involved in digital audio at this point, and the feeling I got up in Toronto is that there are quite a number of people, though by no means a majority of the members of the Audio Engineering Society, who are aware of many of these problems. And the Audio Engineering Society has a preservation committee chaired by Bill Storm, and there are various subcommittees dealing with different aspects of all the audio problems they are concerned about. And it looks like there's a lot of education required by the people involved in preservation, which includes many of the people here, of the line engineers to let them know that there are problems, or to establish that there are problems, so that the eyewash from the manufacturers who have a product to sell and money to reclaim and presumably make doesn't simply overwhelm the body of general knowledge concerning the products that they make.
Do you have a comment to that?
Okay. J.F. Weber, one of the speakers made a passing reference to restoration work being done at Harmonia Mundi. Is that France or Germany? And
it's Switzerland.
Okay.
It's a company that makes digital workstations, and okay. is separate and I think distinct from the companies making
the
two recordings.
Record labels.
I'm sorry?
The two distinct.
Yes. The two indistinct companies.
What business is the Swiss company in?
They make digital workstations. A workstation being a computer with a hard disk onto which the material is then stored and manipulated as if it's a word processing program, so that you don't go onto tape or some other medium with your digital signal and then have to either go in with a razor blade or any one of a number of the, or some of the other post-production processing devices. You can work it right on the disk, and you can tear up a number of different channels and move things around and tell it to move from here to there, and not lose any of the stages in between. You just simply reroute it differently. This is a very exciting and extremely expensive development in the recording end of digital. The machines sell anywhere, depending on how much time you want to put on them, anywhere from $50,000 to $200,000 for the basic machine, and all the outboard drives that go with it. You have to really be in the record business to use them today, but that technology will allow certain kinds of developments which are being strongly considered right now, but which are simply financially impractical for the returns involved until the prices drop. And I think they will drop.
All right, Jerry Gibson, the Library of Congress, again, he says. what I'm about to say is, I think, points out one of the major factors that collectors, whether they're institutional or personal, private, have with preservation of, and maintaining their collections. There is very little scientific control, information, research, documentation, et cetera, on many of the topics that have been stressed here today, specifically cleaning set. The Library of Congress has used Freon TF, in my personal experience, for over 15 years for cleaning acetate discs, both by hand and in an ultrasonic machine designed and built specifically for us. To my knowledge, and I can easily be corrected, but to my knowledge, We have not experienced the delamination problems because of that cleaning process, which you anticipated as a possibility.
Well, let me ask you something. Are these discs then put into airtight shield pack sleeves after that?
Some are, some are not.
Uh-huh. I know you did a study, because the ones I've seen, the ones that were just thrown back into sleeves and thrown on shelves like most private collectors would do.
We do approximately 10,000 acetate discs a year that are cleaned, taped, and are retained. And in a minor exception, less than 5% of the acetate discs are not retained, mainly because we borrow them for a particular project or process. I think it is something that definitely needs to be explored, if for no other reason than if we believe what we're told about what Freon is doing to the atmosphere, to the ozone layer, we will be finding something else to clean with. We will have no option, even though it is a federal agency. But I think that's the one problem. Another question, and once again, the same situation.
Well, I just want to add in here, also, the most important thing that I found in relationship to all of this is that, as Steve Smolin has pointed out, and a number of other engineers have pointed out, is the fact that when you're dealing with acetate, you're dealing with oxygen. If it can be put into some medium that's a vacuum where there is no oxygen, from what I've seen, there hasn't been any further deterioration, because it is an oxidation. For example, that La Mer I played was a disc I had treated back in 1980, and I had kept it in a tin, which was pretty much airtight. And periodically, I took it out and checked it. The disc looked as clean as the day I had cleaned it, until I took it out of the tin and put it up on a shelf for about 6 months, pulled it out, and it looked like that VOA disc you just saw.
I understand the problems you're saying, but
our
experience, both sleeved and hermetically sealed in the sleeve, and we have one collection, NVC radio collection, mm-hmm. which by contract, they specified that we would retain it in the envelopes and the boxes they sent it to us in. We fought it, we thought it was absurd, but mm-hmm. we were told if we wanted the collection, we would do it.
Mm-hmm.
That collection has been being taped for about 8 years now, and
right.
I'm not aware of any unexpected delamination for the age of the materials.
Yeah, because I do know a person did treat a couple of records at Freon which had mold on it, and he went to play it and he said he couldn't get any signal out of it. There was all noise.
Now, we're told, by the way, that the growth that you photographed there, we're told by the library's testing office that that is not mold.
No, then I'm not talking about
okay.
that. I'm talking about a disc that had mold. Someone had asked about that and cleaning it off with Freon. That's what this person did. And
well,
he came up with a problem.
I should also point out that there are various kinds of molds.
Right.
And it's basically a living organism on
right.
the record. What it lives off is the record.
Mm-hmm.
It therefore creates pits where it's already fed.
That's right.
And the point of the exercise is not to blast the mold off, but to prevent the mold from being there. If you must work with the spaces that are left by the mold, it's also advisable, if at all possible, to find alternative copies of the record, no matter how bad the sound may be, even if it's just preserved raw,
right.
so that the kind of processing that Cedar was demonstrating here about parallel processing of the same audio signal may be available to someone in the future.
A comment to Phil and a question for you. Several of you here are aware that a group of us within the ARSC, the AAA specifically at this point, have been discussing with Plasmon the possibility of a similar or complementary type of testing of the Plasmon disc. We are exploring it. We're trying to find the funds and the facilities to work with it, and it's one that we'll be talking more with the British Library. We won't tell you what we find out either. But it is something.
You'll know if it doesn't come.
That's right.
Thank you on behalf of one of the institutions, and as one of the collectors, Phil, for talking to us as intelligent human beings. My experience is many of your competitors don't bother doing so, and addressing us as people who have a reason, and we're not total nuts, so thank you very much. My question is, I may have missed it, did you talk about the actual dollar cost for the discs and for the equipment now available? And if you didn't, could you address that?
Yes, thank you for your comments. As far as recommended retail prices for one-off discs, then a 200 megabyte disc is $65 and a 400 megabyte disc is $115.
And you do have to turn them over physically.
That's right. So a double all of the players on the market at the moment are just single-sided heads, which means that a double-sided disc is just like a double-sided record. You have to physically turn it over, as Steve says. In terms of the playing systems which are on the market, then I actually don't know the recommended retail price for the CompuSonic system. It is of the order of $15,000, $20,000 for a system, whether it be CompuSonics or Prism systems.
Yeah, that's my understanding also. CompuSonics has leased the rights to market it to another outfit. The price used to be $10,000, and so you can see what leasing the rights to market involves.
Certainly the CompuSonic system, there's a license to a UK company called Ferrograph, and I think their recommended retail is £9,000, which must be $14,000.
Paul
Mulvaney from Recordrama Sound Archives, Pittsburgh. In passing, you mentioned the lifespan of the worm disc in terms of centuries.
Yes.
And by comparison, CD-ROM and CD audio discs in terms of decades. Could you be more specific area?
Yeah, I didn't want to be that clear-cut, in as much as I'm not aware of any detailed scientific studies on CDs. I know there's a lot of interest in this area, but I'm personally just not aware of them. My personal belief is that well-made compact discs with thick aluminum layers will have a good lifetime. I don't know what it is, but I'm sure it'll have a very good lifetime. If a compact disc is not as well made, it won't. As far as our particular Write Once discs are concerned, then, as I mentioned, all of the testing indicates lifetimes longer than 150 years, and at that point it was going into the noise. So for our particular platinum technology, I think it's fair for me to say measured in centuries. And I know that for some other Write Once technologies, it's perhaps 10, 20 years. For CDs, I don't know. Quite possibly there are some measured in centuries.
Well,
Radio Shack has announced the release of a recordable CD in the near future. And I understand there's some magnetic processes involved in that. And do you know anything about that involvement with the CD manufacturing process as far as life, useful life, or storage?
We don't even know about the marketing of the device because that's been put off another year. In addition, Yamaha has announced that they've come out with a worm system where you can simply then put the result directly into your CD player. That's a professional item, which means that it's more expensive. I have not seen any yet. I have not seen the brochure on it. Someone has told me about it, though, and it's been confirmed from another source. And there are five or six systems under development, each using, in many cases, well, everybody has his own patent or is hoping to get his own patent. And until that whole market works its way down to one survivor, we are going to be faced with the problem of recording on something on a piece of equipment which may not be available to play it back when the disc lasts long enough that you really want to play it back, as you indicated earlier about another issue. As far as the lifetime of the CD is concerned, the other factors involved, there was a problem with bad inks that were therefore reacting, aging under the lamination of the disc. That seems to have been taken care of. There are also a lot of CD plants who have come online to mass market the product, to make as many as they can get out, and there have been difficulties with the sealing of the edges. The CD being a laminated product, if the edges become unsealed, they start to oxidize from the outside in and possibly from the inside, from the hub out, depending on how it's been made. So there's a lot of other factors involved having to do simply with the mechanics of production that determine the CD's potential life.
There are world standards which were set by Sony and Philips and accepted worldwide. And
they are not
therein lies the problem, because they're collecting a 3-cent royalty on every CD issued in America or in worldwide. And I think that they're probably being extremely lax in policing the manufacturing process.
They have no real place to put the crowbar to force the issue.
Thank you.
This has been looked into, I promise.
Did you have a comment to that?
Just one comment as far as standards are concerned. As far as I know, the standard refers to the format and the reflectivities. It doesn't refer to the quality of production of the disc, which is a different matter.
Alan Ward from the National Sound Archive in London. I should know this since we're involved in the tests, but I'm not really clear about it. One of the weaknesses of the ordinary standard CD in the long term, from the point of view of its physical survival, is often stated to be the fact that you've only got a polycarbonate layer on one side, and the other side is a lacquer layer which encloses the label details and so on. So one side is weaker than the other, and if there is any physical damage, it could easily damage the metal layer through the weaker of the two sides. The polycarbonate side is probably all right, but not the other side. I'm not certain of the truth of this, but it's often stated. Now, the worm disc that you illustrated had polycarbonate on both sides, but that was a double-sided one. What about the single-sided ones?
Oh, right. A single-sided disc has exactly the same construction. It's just that the second substrate of polycarbonate doesn't have a platinum layer on it.
Right, thanks.
I need to ask you another question, Phil. Could you elaborate a little bit on the three options you put forward for the ability to play this item in the year 2100 or beyond? Do you see any advantages, disadvantages, or possibilities of any one of the three?
Taking the low volume production route, and I think it's, I basically put those three options up as for discussion and for a detailed, I think actually, cost and feasibility analysis, which is what it wants. As far as the taking a machine such as that over there, which is a high volume production machine, and looking at the implications and costs of making it small scale, it'll be probably 20 times as big, have 20 or 30 times as many components in it, but it'll be eminently more repairable. I don't know what the cost impact of that is. But I think that's the crux. And it's whether the manufacturer, which is Matsushita in Japan, for instance, for that machine, is willing to collaborate. So that's something which does need to be got into. As far as having a planned copying scheme, then, for instance, one could use current jukeboxes, which would take 50 double-sided discs. A jukebox such as that will cost about $35,000. So you could imagine having a third of $1 million investment for a national archiving body, which would provide 10 such jukeboxes. They would be just loaded up every day for a year or two or three, and one would copy across onto the medium of the day in perhaps 50 years' time. That poses yet another problem, in as much as you have to maintain the jukeboxes. So again, that really has to be looked into. But when you look at the number of recorded hours which could be converted with that sort of investment, it's really quite large. With a drive operating at twice normal speed, it's 175,000 hours per year, which means that you could copy a reasonably sized collection in a time frame of a year or two or five. So that's feasible, and again, it should be looked at, I think, in terms of the cost analysis.
We are getting near the end of our session.
We were getting near the end of our session. 175,000 hours a year is very promising, but if you take it, simply rounding it out at $100 per hour for the product, for your product alone, that comes to $175 million for the laser disc to record onto, not to mention the time, the staff, the cataloging, and the labeling problems. So we are looking at $175 million, if my math is correct. I don't think the U.S. Congress, I don't know about New York Public Library or other people, but I don't think the U.S. Congress would like it too much.
If I could just comment on that. At those volumes, I'm sure we could sell them to you at a discount.
Could I make one very brief comment?
By all means.
Collectors, particularly in those publications that zero in on jazz recordings of the genre 23 to 35, are being increasingly recommended to use Amaral on their records as a cleaning and polishing agent.
The following
issue. Assuming that you condemn it, how do you get it off?
I have no way of knowing how to get it off. The succeeding issue of Jocelyn's Jazz Journal, in which that article appeared, had an article by someone else saying, you do that, you're nuts, I'm a professional record dealer, and if I know you've treated your records with Amaral, I simply will not buy your collection at any price because my reputation will be mud if I try and then sell them. Let's sum up here. If there are any remarks from the panel, do you have anything further to add, Seth?
No, it's just that, as when I had spoken with Steve Smoley, and when we're working with acetate-based material, we're working against time. I think we're living on borrowed time right now on a lot of this material, especially when you get stuff from the 1930s, which are now approaching 60 years in age. You know, things. Why should it be that in the Toscanini collection, I can pull things out from 1935, they look as good as the day they were done, and I can pull things out from 1954, and they're falling off the base? There's no rhyme or reason. There are certain parameters, like I had mentioned yesterday. I think if you go through your collection and look for discs that are stamped Allied, I guarantee you everyone's going to be pitted. There was something about the consistency of
and censured.
And I'd simply like to say thank you for the invitation to speak.
Yes.
Well, I'd like to add one little caveat to the end of this because it affects other collections here. We all know now that the lifespan of the acetate disc is finite. We all know that there are problems with nitrate-based film. We have not yet seemed to have made the connection with the way that cylinders are manufactured. It seems to me that the lifespan of cylinders is going to suddenly become a major issue of concern to many people here. And I think that those of you who are interested in cylinders might consider putting some material together to find out what you can do to protect them. Thank you very much.